Today we're going to wrap up learning, and then we're going to move on to nature and nurture and human diversity for the rest of the time. So we're going to talk about the constraining roles of biology and cognition upon learning. But first, I wanted to come back to something that we touched on briefly in classical conditioning on Tuesday, but that I didn't really have time to elaborate on, which is the idea of, you know, how can we use classical conditioning and our knowledge of the principles of classical conditioning to help people who have phobias, right? We talked about a few different ways that people could learn or acquire such phobias, but we didn't really get a chance to talk about how we could apply it to help people, right? So there's a couple different ways that you can use classical conditioning. You can use extinction or counter-conditioning, and we'll talk about each of these. But let's say, you know, as an example, that you have a fear of clowns, okay? You dislike clowns because in childhood, their appearance often preceded being ridiculed, which makes you unhappy, okay? So what's the unconditioned stimulus in this scenario? Being ridiculed, yes. And the unconditioned response? Feeling unhappy, right, okay. So what's the conditioned stimulus? Clowns, and conditioned response? Okay, good. So the underlying relationship, right, is this idea that socially being ridiculed makes you unhappy. Clowns have become linked with this for you because often in childhood, the appearance of a clown preceded being ridiculed. Does that make sense? Okay, so there's a couple different ways that we could work with this relationship to help someone kind of reduce their fear of clowns. So this is the relationship we're working with. If you wanted to use extinction, do you guys remember what extinction is? How do you do that? Say again? Yeah, so the association has kind of weakened in its strength. But how is it that you make something go extinct? What do you present to a person? Yeah. Good, so you present just the conditioned stimulus without the unconditioned stimulus. And here, the conditioned stimulus is a clown, right? Unconditioned stimulus is ridicule. So what you can do then is present a lot of nice clowns, right? Who don't ridicule you. Thus, it breaks the association between clowns and ridicule. Does that make sense? So one way of working on phobias. So the relationship in this way between the conditioned stimulus and the conditioned response between clowns and unhappiness will fade, right? Okay. And the relationship between clowns and ridicule. And clowns will again become neutral, which is what they should have been originally. Okay? Now, counterconditioning is slightly different. This is where you replace the response with a response that's incompatible with the original response. So a response that's opposite of this unhappiness, like calmness or happiness. Okay? So you would give people exercises to help them calm themselves down whenever they're presented with a clown. Give them kind of techniques they can use, like deep breathing, and kind of meditative focus, whatever it is that you think might help. And then you show them gradually scarier and scarier clowns while they practice their relaxation exercises, right, as they're viewing clowns. And this is relying on a different underlying relationship between an unconditioned stimulus of like deep breathing and relaxation and an unconditioned response of being calm and happy. Okay, so by pairing a clown repeatedly with deep breathing, you're counter-conditioning this person, okay? So now the relationship between clowns and ridicule is weaker than the relationship between clowns and deep breathing, and now the response that you're getting to the stimulus of happiness and calmness is incompatible with the original response, which was unhappiness and distress. Does that make sense? So you're conditioning a different relationship. You're trying to replace the original response with something that's incompatible, and in this case, it's calmness. Are you with me? Yeah. Do something like spiders? Yeah, well, this is actually how they treat phobias, right, with systematic desensitization. So you would have a person, if you're really scared of spiders, you come up with, like, a list of increasingly distressing situations involving spiders, okay? So maybe the least distressing would be just thinking about it or seeing a picture of it, like a cartoon of a spider, right? And then you gradually progress to, like, pictures of scarier and scarier spiders. And then you actually interact with a spider in the lab, and the whole time you're doing this deep breathing exercise. So you're breaking the association between spiders and panic by reconditioning someone to experience calm when they encounter a spider. Does that make sense? Yeah, so they actually use this in treating phobias. Are you with me? Okay, so two ways we can use classical conditioning to help people with phobias: extinction and counter-conditioning. Cool? Any questions? Yeah? Things that we're innately scared of? Like a loud noise. That's a good question. I feel like that would be a lot harder, right, to break the relationship between a loud noise and panic. But I think if you were able to calm yourself down enough, you could maybe override it. Yeah, that's a good question. Anything else? Yeah?
What about for, like, people who are afraid of flying? Is that a lot of people
it's a very similar kind of situation where you give someone a tool to stay calm. In that case, it's a drug, right? If you're having someone fly with different levels of prescription drugs to help them calm down, it's the same kind of idea that you're creating this association, you're breaking the association between airplanes and panic, and instead having airplanes and calm, kind of happiness whacked out on some crazy drugs, right, trying to calm you down. You're reconditioning someone. Does that make sense? So it's similar to treating like the spider phobia. You'd probably think about flying, you know, and maybe see pictures of flying or watch a movie about flying before you actually got on a plane. But if you're going to treat it, you need to take steps. Does that make sense? Okay. Cool. All right. So the new relationship here, right, is between the clown and deep breathing instead of the clown and ridicule. All right. So we've talked about behaviorism, classical conditioning, and operant conditioning. And now let's talk about what are the constraining roles of biology and cognition upon learning. So let's see. There are biological constraints upon learning because some animals are unable to be conditioned in some ways because of innate tendencies. Okay, it's easier to teach a cat to meow than to teach a dog to meow. Okay, does that make sense? That if it's something that's not natural to a species, it's more difficult to condition them. So they're not sort of tabula rasa. They're not coming in a totally blank slate. There are underlying tendencies. So another example is when reinforcing an animal with food, it's easier to condition food-searching behaviors, like pecking or digging, than it is to condition non-food-related behaviors, like face washing or wing flapping. Okay, so things that have a biological link to the process that you're trying to condition, it's easier to teach an animal to do those things, okay, rather than something that's unrelated. And another example here is that rats can be conditioned to associate a taste with nausea. Okay, if you pair a food repeatedly with radiation or some kind of nauseating drugs, but it's harder to teach a rat to associate lights or sounds with nausea. Okay, it's easier to associate food with nausea than lights or sound with nausea. Why do you think that might be? What's the difference between these relationships? Why would it be harder to teach a rat to associate lights with nausea than food with nausea? Yeah, so light is simply like not relevant to your digestive system, right? Food is, lights are much more distantly connected to it. So I think you're right. Does that make sense, you guys? And it's easier to teach some associations than others. All right, easier to associate a taste with nausea than lights. And even if the punishment for eating something nauseating didn't occur until hours later, right, if the nausea was really delayed, people can still learn these links and animals can still learn these links. Right, so if you get food poisoning and you get sick like late at night, you might develop a taste aversion to something that you ate several hours earlier, even though it wasn't an immediate response, right? And we talked about how punishment and reinforcement have to occur pretty soon after the behavior for them to be perceived as relevant and actually enact changes upon learning. When it comes to food poisoning, it can happen several hours later, okay, suggesting that there is some kind of biological foundation to this relationship. Are you with me? Questions? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. It's adaptive. It seems to be biologically driven and probably evolved. Good. Okay. So this is known as learned taste aversions, right? If you're this guy and you ate a bunch of nasty food at the ballpark and you felt sick later, you're going to have a strong association between those behaviors. Okay. You're going to avoid eating that food again in the future, maybe. Maybe not, right? You might not care. But this is known as the Garcia effect, that there are some links, right, between food and nausea, between lights and shocks, that are more easily learned than others. Okay? All right. So, speaking of evolution, there's a little bit of information about evolution and learning. So, organisms are better at learning behaviors that are ecologically relevant, meaning relevant to their survival or reproduction in their environment. And we readily learn things that are favored by natural selection. So, an example of this is that there's a natural association between the color red and sexuality. Okay? So, red is associated with blushing, right, which is a relevant process to flirtation and sexual excitation in humans, and it displays, it's like a signal of ovulation in other primates. Okay, so red is evolutionarily linked to sex, okay, linked to attraction. And both men and women find partners more attractive when they're framed in red. Like if you showed someone one of these two pictures, they would find the girl framed in red more attractive than the girl framed in black and white. Okay. Similarly, if someone is wearing red, you'll find them more attractive than when they're not wearing red. So what do you think of this? Do you buy it? Do you find yourself wearing red at certain times, or perhaps red lipstick, ladies? So there might be something to the association, right, between red and sexuality. Make sense? Are there any other reasons that you think red might be linked to sexuality? Would a certain person wear red more often? Think it's linked to personality at all? Anybody? Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of more extroverted, right? It's a little more like, look at me, I'm cool, right? You should hang out with me. Yeah, so it might be something that it reflects a more dynamic or like outgoing personality, and that could also be linked to different patterns in sexuality. Okay, cool. So those are some evolutionary and biological constraints. Now in terms of cognitive constraints on learning, remember that behaviorism banishes talking about any kind of cognition. In behaviorism, we talk about stimulus and response, and there's absolutely nothing going on in between, right? The mind is a black box. You are not to infer anything about what an organism is thinking. However, we do know that animals learn the predictability of events. Okay, so animals seem to consciously come to expect things in classical conditioning. So if you are using a shock, right, as an unconditioned stimulus, and you are trying to pair that with a tone and a light, and the tone is always predictive of getting the shock, and the light is only sometimes predictive of getting the shock, animals learn that the tone will always predict the shock, and they'll start to react as if to prepare for the shock, more so than the light. Okay, so they learn that one is a more informative signal than another. Does that make sense? They won't react as strongly to the light because it doesn't always predict the shock, but they react strongly to the tone because it does always predict the shock, which suggests that there's some kind of consciousness going on, right? They're anticipating what's going to happen. Does that make sense how that goes against kind of the principles of behaviorism? Yes? No? Nothing? Okay, well, any questions on this? About how behaviorism is not about inferring anything internal and yet there does seem to be a cognitive conscious component to learning? No? All right, well, we'll move on. So more examples of cognition. So we know that animals also learn without rewards. Okay, if the idea is that we only do behaviors more because we get rewarded for them, right? We shouldn't see any changes in learning, any changes in behavior, if there aren't any rewards present. There's no external incentive. Because theoretically, there's no cognition going on inside. It's only a response to, there's a stimulus and a response, and that's it. So we do know, however, that rats will develop cognitive maps of mazes without being reinforced. Okay, they do seem to be latently learning what's going on in the maze. So if you look at this graph here, we've got three groups of rats. We've got rats who were never rewarded in the blue line, and you can see that their performance in the maze stays pretty standard across 17 days. We have rats that were regularly rewarded with the red line, and their performance gets better, right? This is standard behaviorism. If you reward a rat for finishing a maze, the rat will do it more often. Okay. Rats in this green group, however, were just kind of hanging out like the blue rats with no reward for the first 11 days, and after that, they started getting rewarded. However, you can see that as soon as they started getting rewarded, their error rate dropped very quickly, suggesting that they were gathering the information about the maze while they were navigating it, even though they weren't rewarded for doing so. Does that make sense, how this is latent learning? That they suddenly show that they do know what's going on in the maze as soon as they're rewarded, but it does suggest that they were learning the maze latently. Are you with me? Questions? Okay. So we know humans, too, can learn without rewards, right? In fact, excessive rewards can hurt our internal motivation. So we talk about two different types of motivation, intrinsic and extrinsic. Intrinsic motivation is a desire to perform a behavior for its own sake because you want to. It's internally motivated. You read a book because you like to read, right? Extrinsic motivation, instead, is your desire to perform a behavior for some kind of external reason, okay? To get a reward, to avoid a punishment, to get social approval, to avoid social disapproval, etc. Now, the thing is, if you reward a child for reading with toys or candy, you'll actually diminish their time spent reading the next time. Okay? So if you provide an extrinsic motivation for a behavior, you find that the intrinsic motivation diminishes. So why do you think that might be? Why is it that giving a reward would lead someone to be less motivated to do it in the future? Yeah. I think they're focusing more on the treat than on the reading. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So they're focusing only on the reward and not on the reading itself. What else? I think that those are both good intuitions. But why would it affect like your internal motivation to read? You're getting rewarded for doing it externally. Exactly. It's like, if I have to be bribed into doing this, I must not actually like it. Okay, so you're going to actually reduce intrinsic motivation by providing too much extrinsic motivation. Okay, and this is probably relevant to getting rewards for good grades, right? If you were rewarded by your parents for like, you know, $100 for every A or something like that, you could see that perhaps over time this would diminish your intrinsic motivation to do well in school. Does that make sense? Okay. So, let's talk a little bit about insight as well. So as you watch this video, try to think about how behaviorism would explain this behavior. Okay, that little yellow thing is a treat. And this pigeon has never done this before. He got the treat. Okay? So, how would a behaviorist explain this? What would they say? You're not allowed to talk about what's going on inside the bird's brain. What do you think they would say? Would they have an explanation for it? Yeah. Yeah. It's just like behaving randomly, essentially, right? Until something good happens. And then it'll do it again. But since this is the first time the bird is ever encountering it, kind of problematic, right? Suggesting that there might be some kind of, and we know, right, that we've moved past the behaviorist perspective at this point. We know that we do have internal cognitions and motivations, and we're able to have insight into problems, but I'm just giving this as an example of something that a behaviorist would have a really hard time explaining. Does that make sense? Okay. Cool. So this is insight learning, right, which is sudden understanding about a problem that's never been reinforced. And we know that the behaviorist would be kind of stumped by this behavior. All right, so let's talk about observational learning. And we're going to talk about media violence and violent behavior and how those two things might be related. So, although we've been talking a lot about, you know, rewards and punishments and different kinds of stimuli and responses, we know that humans and other organisms also sometimes learn without direct experience, just by watching and observing others and imitating other people. We're amazingly social creatures, right? We have a lot of relationships that are important to us. And your parents and your siblings and your friends frequently model behavior for you, and you vicariously learn to do or not do certain things, right? You learn not to touch the stove or drink too much. You learn how to get along with people, right? How to have relationships. And we're especially likely to learn from others who we see as similar to us, successful, and admirable. Okay? And the famous Bobo doll study looked at observational learning. Okay, so this is probably our most famous study as a field, and the child in these videos, I'm going to show you a video, is playing in a room, right, and it observes an adult beating up a large inflatable, like, punching doll, like a Bobo doll that you knock it down and it comes back up, right? So the child watches an adult beating up this doll, and then the child is taken to a room full of fun toys and is told, no, these toys are for the other children, okay? And then they're brought into another room that just has a Bobo doll, and maybe some other broken toys. So let's watch what happens with the child when they're left alone with the Bobo doll After observing the adult, beat it up. 1 second. Maybe you've seen this, but...
It was once widely believed that seeing others' transgressions would drain the viewer's aggressive drive. As you can see, exposure to aggressive modeling is hardly a start. Exposure to aggressive modeling increased attraction to guns, even though it was never modeled. Guns had less appeal to children who had no exposure to aggressive modeling. The children also picked up the novel hostile language.
This is my favorite part.
The room contained varied play material. The children could choose to play aggressively. The children devised new ways of hitting the ball. The object of interest was the novel aggressive act, not punching the doll. The children in the control group who had no exposure to the aggressive modeling never exhibited the novel form of aggression. Here's a creative embellishment. The doll becomes a weapon of assault.
Ha ha. That little girl in her precious dress just cracks me up. So what happened here? Can someone describe like what the results are, what we should take home from this? What do you guys think? What happened in the video I just showed you? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Children are emulating the behavior of adults. Good. So when the child is left alone with the Bobo doll, right, after watching this violent modeling, this violent behavior by the adults, they beat the living daylight out of this doll, specifically modeling the behaviors of the adults, right, sitting on it and beating it with a hammer, and then also picking up guns and trying different ways of hurting the doll, right? It even inspired creativity in violence. So this is a pretty powerful demonstration of observational learning, right, and imitation. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so. It seems like this might be a slightly different iteration where there were other toys available. So it seems like they might not necessarily have to be frustrated beforehand, but in your book it describes them being frustrated before being given the chance to take out that aggression. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Dolls, yeah. Yeah, you're right. They went above and beyond what they'd seen, right? Somehow there were some norms lifted here and they could do whatever they wanted. Okay, cool. So this is the Bobo doll study, right, by Bandura. So we know that observational learning also occurs among apes. One more video for you.
To prove that one ape could copy another, a student of Andrew Whiten's devised an experiment. At the University of Texas, Antoine Spiteri has built a kind of slot machine for apes. He loads it with a grip. To get the fruit, a chimp must first turn a disc to allow the grape to drop through a hole. Next, a chimp must move a door that opens a handle to release the fruit payout. Spiteri now trains a chimp named Julie how to work. On her own, she would never work it out. But thanks to a sweet liquid reward, she learned the sequence's two steps. Rotate, then push. Next, Judy's group mates enter. So Terry wants to know if, just by watching, the spectators will learn the technique. Can these apes aim to win this food-finding game? One chimp seems to think she's got it and shoves Judy aside. A minute ago, Judy was the only one with the knowledge. Now, another had it, and quickly the trick spread throughout the group. But for Spiteri, the most important question remains. Have the next-door neighbors also learned the solution? They have no social ties to the original group. In fact, they are hostile towards it. Will they set that aside to keep up with the Joneses next door? In no time at all, they're working the slot machine like all the pros. Rotating, then pushing the handle. Learning by imitation is an essential skill for culture. And culture, along with the complex thoughts and emotions behind it, was long believed to be uniquely human.
Okay, so we see evidence of observational learning even among other species, right? This was originally taught via behaviorism, right? The first ape was rewarded, first chimp was rewarded with some sweet water, right, for doing the right steps, but then other members of both that chimp's group and an opposite, like opposing hostile group picked up on the behavior, right? Suggesting observational learning is very real. So there might be some neurons in our brain that support this process and support observational learning called mirror neurons. The idea is that our intense sociality, right, our need for connection to one another, is also reflected in the brain. So we may, I say may because it's new research and it's somewhat tentative, but it's this kind of cool finding that we might have mirror neurons that activate merely upon observing someone else have an experience, Okay, so if you're watching someone else eat ice cream, the reward centers in your brain are lighting up as well. Okay, if you've ever watched Mad Men and wanted a cigarette afterwards, this could be because smokers' brains simulate smoking when they see it in the movies. Similarly, while you're reading a novel, you mentally simulate the experiences. Okay, you see the brain light up in a way consistent with having those experiences yourself, suggesting that there is some kind of biological, neurological basis to this observational learning. And even if we lack these neurons, right, even if it's discovered that mirror neurons are not actually real, we're still incredibly empathic and prone to imitation. And in fact, being imitative of one another is very good for relationships. So if you subtly mimic your friend's postures and kind of gestures and lean the direction they're leaning and cross your legs when they cross their legs, you're going to get along better and they're going to like you more. Okay? You'll be more familiar, more similar to them, and you'll become closer as friends. So be cool about it, right? But try to mimic people subtly and you might see some positive benefits. Okay? So mimicry is cool. All right, so let's talk about media violence, given what we've just learned about observational learning and mirror neurons. So we know that correlationally, violent media consumption is associated with greater violence. Okay, so watching more violent movies, playing more violent video games is associated with more violent behavior. So individuals are prone to more fights and violence the more they engage in these media activities, and societies as a whole have higher homicide rates when they have higher rates of violent media in their culture. But is it causal, right? What would be the correlational explanation? Why might this not be causal, this link between violent behavior and violent media? What kind of relationship might be underlying it? Do you think it's true that violent media causes violent behavior? What do you think? Yeah. Maybe they seek it out more, right? And that might even be true. But how would you design an experiment to test like a causal explanation for this? What would you do to see if violent media causes more violent behavior? Yeah. I think that's a great idea. Perfect. So create two groups, show one violent video games or have them play violent video games, have the other group play a neutral one, and then see how violent they become. And that work has actually been done. So excellent line of thinking. So when researchers randomly assign students to watch violent versus nonviolent entertainment and measure their violent behavior afterwards, controlling for pre-existing differences in hostility and aggression that might have drawn people towards that media or made them enjoy it more, they found that heavy exposure to violent media increased aggression. Okay. And here's another study showing that looking at how much violent media you're exposed to at one point in time predicts how many fights you get into later on. Okay, so there does seem to be a connection between media exposure, media consumption, and violent behavior. And there are two factors that have been proposed to explain this relationship, imitation and desensitization. So, imitation is the idea that, as we've been talking about with mirror neurons, right, our brains simulate violent behavior while viewing violence. And after this internal rehearsal, it becomes easier for us to act it out. Right? It becomes more natural. We've already kind of practiced it internally, so why not behave this way? Okay, it's imitative. So if you show kids like the Power Rangers for the first time, you suddenly see them doing specific violent acts that they just observed, like flying karate kicks, right? Or in the Bobo doll study, you see them doing the exact things that they were modeled by the adult. So there is some aspect of imitation. Desensitization is the other explanation, that watching violence breeds indifference to it, right? I know that when I go into a violent movie at the beginning, I'm really kind of agitated, and by the end, it doesn't even bother me anymore, right? There's kind of this course of desensitization that happens, that if you watch more violent media, it turns out that men who watch movies with sexual violence are less bothered by rape and by slashing. They're less sympathetic towards domestic violence victims, and they're less likely to see a victim's injuries as severe. Okay, so there are real differences that exposure to violent movies has or creates upon your perceptions of violence, your tolerance for violence, etc. And there's also an overall reduction in sympathy that results from watching violent media. So an observational study showed that while leaving a violent movie, People are less likely to help an injured woman pick up her crutches than if they're leaving a nonviolent movie. Okay? So just sitting in a movie for a couple hours created this. Yeah. Right, that there could be some kind of violent media that, yeah, it makes you feel more sympathetic. I think that's possible. It would depend, like, how violent it is, right? Because sympathy and empathy can be kind of exhausting or draining if the person you're watching is suffering the entire time, right? It can be like a costly, difficult thing, so it would depend kind of on the level. But I think you're right, that if it were presented in the right way, maybe it would help. But your brain might still be imitating it, right? You might still be kind of preparing yourself to act that way. But I think you're right. It's not necessarily a black and white issue. Other thoughts on this? Okay, so even though you might really enjoy violent movies and violent video games, right? A lot of people do. There's a reason they exist. And you might feel that you personally are an exception to this rule, that you would help the woman who dropped her crutches, right? You wouldn't be aggressive. You should be aware that you might be changing your own views on violence, right? Both sexual violence and non. And you might be shutting down your tendency for empathy and sympathy. So, you know, just think about it for, you know, couple minutes, like especially if and when you start having kids, just because you consumed a lot of violent media and turned out okay doesn't mean that they should, right? It causes these differences. Any other thoughts on this? Or any questions on learning in general before we move on? No? Okay. We're going to move on to nature and nurture and human diversity. Okay, so this is material drawn from chapter 4 and chapter 11 on nature and nurture, human diversity, and human sexuality. I've turned human sexuality into its own slideshow, so we'll do that a little bit later, not today. But for now, this is our outline. We're going to talk about behavior genetics, talk about twin studies and adoption studies, talk about heritability and epigenetics, and then experience and development. What's the influence of parents versus peers upon your personality and your values, your ethics? We're going to talk about cultural variations in human diversity, evolutionary psych, which I know we touched on a little bit in this class, but we'll talk about natural selection and human sexuality, and then we'll talk about gender development, and then human sex. Okay? So, behavioral genetics. What is it? It is the study of the relative power and limits of genetic and environmental influences on our behavior, right? So when someone asks you, is it nature or nurture that's causing this personality trait or this, you know, sexual orientation, et cetera, behavioral genetics tries to answer those questions. So behavioral genetics asks, in what ways are we a product of our genes versus a product of our environment? Environment has a kind of broad definition in that it is every non-genetic influence, okay? So it's nutrition, it's your home environment, it's your friend group, it's the classrooms that you sit in, et cetera, okay? Environment. It's pretty much everything except genes. And then the other question is, how do genes and environment interact with each other to produce behavior and produce human diversity? So we know that we're defined in part by our genotype, which is our DNA, right, our genes. And our genotype may or may not be fully expressed in our phenotype, which is our external observable characteristics. Okay, so even if you have two very tall parents and you have very tall genes and a tall genotype, if you never ate anything nutritious, you wouldn't be very tall. Right? That genotype would not necessarily be expressed in your phenotype. So there's not a one-to-one correspondence between genotype and phenotype. Genes don't dictate everything. You need to think about the influence of environment as well upon the expression of that genotype. You with me so far? Genotype is genetic code. Phenotype is the external, observable, physical expression of that code. Okay? All right. So twin studies are very valuable in trying to tease apart the effects of the environment versus genetics upon who we are, because they provide a natural sort of experiment. Okay, so there are two types of twins. There are identical twins and fraternal twins. Identical twins come from a single egg, okay, that splits. They share 100% of their genetic material. They are genetically identical. Okay, they can have slightly different experiences in the womb, can hook onto different placentas, but in general, identical twins have the exact same genes. Okay. Fraternal twins, instead, come from two separate eggs that just happen to be fertilized at the same time. So these are basically just genetic siblings. They share 50% of their genetic code. OK? Okay, no different than just two regular siblings. Okay, so identical twins versus fraternal twins. So you can use these two types of twins to look at the influence of environment versus genes. So if you wanted to figure out the effect of genetics, you would control the environment and vary the genes, right? Manipulating the genes would let you see what the differences are that arise from having slightly different genetic codes. So in order to parse out the effect of genes, you look at identical versus fraternal twins raised together. And we'll talk about this more in a second. To look at the effect of environment, you look at identical twins raised apart versus fraternal twins raised apart. Now, again, we talked about identical twins are monozygotic, meaning one egg, right? They develop from a single egg, genetically identical, 100% of genes. Fraternal twins, only 50%. So, just one example of kind of the power of being a twin at some time. So there's these two twins, the Jim twins, Jim Lewis and Jim Springer. These are monozygotic identical twins. They share 100% of their genetic material. They were separated about a month after being born, and they didn't know the other one existed until 38 years later when they were reunited. And there were a lot of kind of eerie similarities between them. So they both had first wives named Linda and second wives named Betty. Okay. They had habits of leaving love notes to Betty around the house. They both had dogs named Toy. They both had sons that they named James Allen. One used two L's, one used one. They both had a love for woodworking, and they both built white benches circling a tree in their front yard. These guys did not know each other, right? They both had a Chevy. They both liked watching stock car racing and drinking Miller Lite. And they both were in pretty good health, except they had migraines, moderately high blood pressure, they were chain smokers, they were slightly overweight. Okay, so this is an extremely, you know, rare case, but an illustration of what can happen when you share 100% of your genetic material, right? So twins can be very cool. Okay, so the logic of twin studies. All right, this can be a little tricky, so bear with me. So to tease out the effect of genes, what you do is compare identical twins raised together to fraternal twins raised together. Okay, and when you're doing these comparisons, you're looking at similarity within the pairs. So pair one might be twin one and twin two. Pair two might be twin three and twin four. And what you're doing when you're looking at this similarity is looking at how similar is twin one to twin two in comparison to how similar T3 is to T4. Okay? So within pairs, you're saying, okay, how similar are they in terms of their extroversion? Right? If pair one has greater similarity than pair two, you can make an inference about the influence of that. Okay? So you're comparing within pairs in terms of similarity. So, when you're teasing out the effect of genes, we have this assumption that the environment is constant because these pairs are always raised in shared environments. Okay? Identical twins raised together and fraternal twins raised together. So, if we find that identical twins are more similar to each other and fraternal twins are less similar to each other, we can infer that the greater similarity is due to the greater genetic overlap of identical twins. Okay? They share 100% of their genes. Does that make sense? So you look at the differences, holding environment constant within the pairs, in the similarity within the pairs. Now, to tease out the effect of the environment, you compare identical twins raised together to identical twins raised apart. Both of these pairs share 100% of their genetic material. Okay, so any differences that emerge between them has to be due to having a shared environment versus a non-shared environment. So genes, in this case, are constant, right? The pairs always share 100% of their genes. And if we find that identical twins raised together are more similar to each other, and identical twins raised apart are less similar to each other, we can infer that this is due to the environment. Okay, so do you want me to go over that again, or are you with me? Raise your hand if you want me to go over it again. Okay, all right. So we'll just do a quick recap. So to get the effect of genes, you hold the environment constant. You compare identical twins raised together to fraternal twins raised together. The only difference between these pairs is the amount of genetic material that they have in common. Okay, so if identical twins are more similar than fraternal twins, you can infer that this is due to them sharing 100% of their genes. Okay, it's due to genetic components. Yeah? Yes. Yeah, we usually use twins in these studies because twins can be treated kind of more similarly to each other than regular siblings, and they're born at the same time, they're the same age, right? They have the same kind of experiences. It's a good question. Yes, essentially, you could be using regular siblings. Yeah. Okay, but to get the effect of the environment, you hold genetics constant, right? Everyone always shares 100% of their genes, and you just look at whether they're raised together or raised apart. If twins who were raised together have more similar levels of extroversion than twins who were raised apart, you can say there's something to that home environment that caused the greater similarity in extroversion in the identical twins raised together. Okay? Yeah. Extroversion is like a personality variable, describes like how outgoing you are. I'm just trying to use like some kind of concrete example, or how friendly they are. You could say the same thing, right? Just in terms of similarity. Okay? So this is the logic twin study. In that case, you're varying both genetics and the environment, so you can't say what's causing the differences. Okay, so the advantage of using twin studies is that you have control over one or the other. You look at either people who grew up in the same environment, both pairs grew up in the same environment, or both pairs share 100% of their genes. If you're varying two things, you can't say what's causing the differences. Does that make sense? It's a good question. Okay, so these are twin studies, all right? So let's talk a little bit about the influence of genetic relatives versus adoptive relatives. So when we think about genetic relatives, these are your biological parents and your biological siblings, right? You share genes with them. Environmental relatives are adoptive parents and adoptive siblings, people you grew up with. Now the question is, are adopted children, right, more like their biological parents or more like their adoptive parents? Do you have a guess? You think they're more like biological? Raise your hand. More like adopted? Raise your hand. Okay, so kind of a 50-50, a little more for biological. It turns out that in terms of personality, adopted children are more similar to their biological parents. Okay, so at least for extroversion, like outgoingness and agreeableness, which kind of reflects interpersonal warmth and friendliness, biological parents are more predictive in terms of their genetics than adoptive parents are. So you're more like your bio parents than your adoptive parents in terms of your personality. So a shared household environment has basically no impact on personality. So if you think about how different genetic siblings can be in terms of personality, you can maybe infer this, that just growing up in the same house doesn't necessarily make you more similar in terms of personality. However, the environment, meaning your adoptive parents, do affect your values, your attitudes, your manners, your faith, and your politics. Okay? And moreover, adoptive parents might actually be better parents than biological parents in some cases, because adoptive parents are carefully screened, right? You have to apply to be able to adopt a child. Meaning, or rather, and it turns out that adoptive parents are less likely to neglect their children or abuse them, and less likely to get divorced. So adopted children often end up happier, more stable, and more intelligent than their biological parents by virtue of being brought into this richer environment. Okay? Cool. So, adoption. Now, we just learned that personality has a biological component, right? That extroversion and agreeableness tend to come from your parents. So this is temperament, which is the basic genetic component of personality, of who we are. Okay, so temperament emerges very early in your life, within the first few weeks of being born. You can classify babies in one of three categories. So they can be difficult, right? Having a difficult temperament means that the baby is irritable, and really intense, unpredictable, fidgety, and emotionally easily upset. If you are an easy baby, you're cheerful and quiet and pretty easygoing, you're relaxed, and you're pretty predictable. You're slow to warm up, you tend to resist new people and new situations and withdraw from new things, but eventually, once you get comfortable, you're fine, and you look like an easy baby. Okay? So three different categories that you can classify babies in the very first few weeks of their life. And it turns out that this actually has some kind of stability to it. So these differences persist across the lifespan. So emotionally reactive newborns, meaning like they get freaked out by any kind of new stimulus in the environment and become upset easily, are also emotionally reactive 9-month-olds. Okay? Inhibited and fearful 2-year-olds become shy 8-year-olds and shy adolescents. They're also more physiologically aroused in new situations, meaning they're more kind of like ramped up and anxious and on edge in new situations. Which might have, and it turns out that this fear process, this inhibition, might have roots in serotonin regulation genes. So there might be a genetic component specifically describing inhibition. We know emotionally intense preschoolers tend to become intense young adults, and emotionally reactive 3-year-olds become impulsive and aggressive 21-year-olds. So even across 18 years, you can see that there's some stability in that 3-year-olds who are reactive and impulsive are exactly like this when they're around your age. Any questions on this? Yeah. Emotionally intense young adult, probably like a a young adult who's like brooding a lot, right, experiencing a lot of emotions, thinking a lot about those emotions. Yeah, it's a good question. What else? I'm sure we all know these people who are emotionally very intense, right? Okay. Any other questions? All right. Cool. So now there's another tricky concept in this literature, which is heritability. Okay, so heritability describes the extent to which variation among people on a given trait or quality can be attributed to their differing genes. Okay, so how much do genetics affect differences in a population? Now, when you're talking about heritability, you have to talk about groups of people. Okay, we can't look at any one of you in this room and say, your personality is 80% genetic and 20% environmental. Okay, because you're just one single data point. Okay, we have to look at a group of people. And the idea here is that we need differences to explain differences. Okay, so as I said, you're just a data point. But if you look at like these basketball players in this picture, you see that they come in very different heights, right? Or the Obamas are very different height. And it seems that you need to have differences, right, in height in order for differences in genetics to explain it. You need differences in genes to explain differences in traits. So if everyone in a group had exactly the same genes, say we cloned someone 100 times, right? But they still had a range of height. Some people were very short, and some people were very tall. Okay, they have exactly the same genes. Can we attribute this to heredity? Is there anything genetic to these differences in height? No, right? Everyone has the exact same genes. It has to be the environment. If everyone had the exact same environment, okay, say we took people of a various kind of genetic codes and raised them in identical isolated rooms under identical conditions, and we still found that there was a range of intelligence exhibited by these people, could we say that this is due to the environment? No, right? Everyone had the exact same environment, so these differences must come from heredity. If you're raised in identical environments and there are still differences, there must be some reason that you're different, and if everyone is raised in an exactly identical environment, it has to be genetic. Does that make sense? That you have to have differences to explain differences. So as environments become more similar, heredity, meaning genes, has to become more important in explaining who we are. Okay, has to be more important in predicting differences among people. The differences have to come from somewhere, and if it's not environment, it must be genetics. Are you with me? I think that the clones thing and the identical environment thing kind of help make sense of this. Okay, so heritability, again, is the extent to which differences among people are attributable to genes. Questions on heritability? Okay, cool. You can calculate this from twin studies, but we won't get into that. Now, we've been talking about genes, right? But we know heritability and genetics is not destiny. Even if, you know, there is a genetic component to intelligence or height, friendliness, whatever, without adequate care, right, without the right environment, you might not necessarily become tall or smart. So we know that genes and experience interact with one another in an interesting way. So sociability, for example, isn't due just to genes and isn't due just to the environment. It's about a combination of these factors. So if you had two babies, and you have baby J, who is genetically predisposed to be attractive and sociable, right, and easygoing, this baby kind of won the genetic lottery. So the laid-back, easy, pretty, happy baby. Okay? And then you have baby Q, who is genetically predisposed to be unattractive, unsociable, and difficult. All right? So genetically, right, has some kind of disadvantages. Not a very cute baby, not a very friendly baby. Of these two, you could see as their life goes on that they diverge considerably. So baby J might attract more affectionate care, become warmer and more outgoing, seek out more social activities, build more friendships, have, you know, more social confidence, etc. So is this just genes or is it just the environment? No, it's about the environment acting on what genetics endowed. Okay, these babies came into this world with different genetic codes and this affected their experience. So the genes that they had evoked different responses from others, right? Baby J, which was this like sweet, cute baby, evoked more, maybe more warmth and caregiving from others, right? Learned that relationships were pretty easy to form and easy to maintain, whereas baby Q might not have had that experience, right? So we know that genes can evoke different responses from the environment, and the genes can also lead people to seek out different types of environments. So maybe baby J, who's always had this kind of easygoing personality, is much more comfortable in a big group of people and is more likely to, you know, hang out with new friends or, you know, volunteer ideas in a group, etc. Whereas baby Q might avoid social situations like that, perpetuating his or her social, like, lack of confidence. Does that make sense? That genetics both evoke different reactions from the environment and lead you to select out different environments and seek out conditions that are consistent with who you are. Make sense? Yeah. What do you mean? Elaborate on that a little more. Yeah. Yeah, so you think the environment can affect genetics as well, or affect like... Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have to think about it as kind of like accumulating over many generations. And even baby Q might still reproduce, right? It might still have children like him or her. So it could still perpetuate those genes. Because it doesn't mean that baby Q is going to die, right, or never find a partner, which is how evolution really kind of thinks about this sort of thing, right? So these genes could still be carried on. But I see what you're saying. And let's talk about how environment affects genetics. And maybe this will answer your question, okay? So there's something called epigenetics, okay? This word means in addition to or above and beyond genetics. And epigenetics is a field that studies the molecular mechanisms by which environments affect the expression of genes, okay? So we know that genes have the potential to influence development, right? They create differences in us. But environmental triggers can switch them on or off. So methyl molecules can attach to a strand of DNA at a certain point in that DNA and interfere with the replication of genes in that specific like subset of the strand of DNA. Okay, so your genes, your DNA, can become methylated, which affects how it's expressed. Okay, we'll talk about an example. So infant rats who are deprived of their mother's normal licking, okay, licking being like a soothing, comforting behavior, they clean their babies and you know get like comfort them this way and soothe them. Infant rats who are deprived of this licking relative to those who have normal mother's licking, had more molecules blocking the DNA code that allowed their brain to develop hormone receptors for stress hormones. Meaning, there were more free-floating stress hormones in the brains of these rats who had been deprived of early maternal care. Having more free-floating stress hormones in your brain is not good for you. Okay, it means you're more stressed out. Make sense? Humans have a similar effect. Humans who have suffered from child abuse have the same epigenetic effect, where there are more free-floating stress hormones in the brains of these individuals due to similarly methylated DNA. So both of these are examples of genes reacting to the environment, that a stressful environment can cause differences in the expression of your genes by virtue of something becoming attached to your actual strands of DNA and preventing successful replication of an important aspect of who you are, which is having receptors in your brain to get these stress hormones back into kind of a lock and key situation. Okay, it might seem weird that it's bad to have fewer stress hormone receptors in your brain, but if you think about it, if there's nothing for these stress hormones to like lock into and send their signal, they're just going to be there kind of perpetually, always stressing you out. Okay, so not having the receptors is bad news. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is epigenetics. So genetic expression is regulated by the environment. This is just another reason that we can't answer the nature or nurture question with a clear answer, right? Because nature informs nurture. They're not independent dynamics. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about experience and development and the influence of parents versus peers on who you are. So early experiences affect our brain development and our diversity. They impact our brain and they impact our relationships. So Rosenzweig up on top here and Kretsch are both Berkeley. We're both men who studied at Berkeley, right, who worked here. And they studied the effects of enriched environments versus impoverished environments on the brain. So what they did was they raised young rats in one of two conditions, either in an impoverished environment, which you can see on the left here, which was basically solitary confinement, right? There's nothing to do, there's no one to hang out with, there's no toys, there's nothing. It's just you and a water bottle. Versus an enriched environment where there are other rats and playthings, right? Kind of like a little obstacle course and food and other animals in there with you. And they looked at the size of the brain cortex in these two groups of rats. They found that, as you might expect, those rats who were raised in an enriched environment had heavier and thicker cortices on their brain. And after just 60 days in these different environments, the weight of the cortex of the brains of these rats changed by 10%, and the number of synapses changed by 20%. Okay, so being in this impoverished environment has real consequences for your brain development, and how many, you know, connections there are in your brain, period. Make sense? This applies to humans, too. You see that premature babies who are given massage therapy while they're in the hospital tend to develop faster neurologically and gain weight faster and go home sooner. So how is this similar to being placed in a cage with other rats and toys? What's the connection here? Why do you think that premature babies might be in better shape if they get massage therapy? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so social stimulation and like physical stimulation, right. And we talked about the importance of touch during sensation, right, and how this is really important to relationships between mothers and babies and even to our social relationships. So touch seems to affect our development as well, especially in premature babies. So social and physical stimulation are critical to our development. Make sense? Okay. So we know that our brain develops as we develop. Brain maturation provides huge numbers of neural connections. Okay, your brain is developing rapidly, especially as a young baby. And some neural connections are used, and so they're maintained. And others are left unused, and these connections are pruned. Okay, it's a use it or lose it thing with your neural connections. If you're not using these skills very early in childhood, some of those brain connections might disappear. They will be lost. So early childhood, thus, is a great time to exercise all kinds of neural connections. Like this is a good time to learn a new language, right? Learning a second language as a young child can set you up to do better at grammar in your own language and set you up to learn other languages more rapidly and efficiently. And it also is good to learn an instrument early in childhood. And there's research on string musicians who start playing before age 12 versus after. And kids who started playing their instruments before age 12 have more complex and larger neural circuits supporting their left hand, right, which is where they do the note making. This is an important part of music, right? So early childhood experiences with music affect your brain development and thus affect kind of your ability to do this throughout your life. But even as adults, right, our brains are incredibly plastic, so it's not too late to learn to play the violin or the piano or whatever. Our neural tissue is always changing, and there's new neurons being born constantly in our brain from stem cells. And we know that increasing skill does correspond to changes in brain tissue. Okay, so the better you get at something, the heavier your cortex in that region will become. There are real changes based on experience in your brain. Is that clear? Questions? Okay. Cool. So who matters more, parents or peers? Right? Parents tend to be held accountable for their children. If their kids are great, they get credit for being such great parents. Right? If their kids are lousy, they get blamed for being terrible parents, right, and causing these problems in their children. But how much does parenting really matter? Inasmuch as parenting involves contributing genetic material to your children, it obviously has some influence, right? Depends on heritability of a given quality. But in terms of personality, it turns out that shared environmental influences, meaning like being raised in a household with someone, like your parent, accounts for less than 10% of your personality. You do not necessarily have the same personality as your mother or father. And it turns out that parenting, outside of the extremes of truly awful, abysmal parenting and truly amazing parenting, doesn't do much to sculpt a child's personality, for good or for bad. Okay, so parents should probably relax a little bit and love their kids for who they are, not worry about it. However, peers are incredibly influential in our development and our personality. So why do you think peers are more influential than parents in terms of who we become? That's right. Yes, good. Hopefully it is unconditional love with your parents, right? That's the ideal. So we want to fit in with our peers, right? We want to be accepted by our peers. And we spend most of our time with our peers in development. Yeah. Yes. Yes, there is a relationship between that. And parents can also help their children select peers or force them to hang out with certain people. So it's not totally independent. You're right. Yes, absolutely. That's a good point. Right, so We spend most of our time with our peers, and we might seek out peers who are more like us than we feel that our parents are, right? If you feel like your parents are really conservative and you're liberal, you're probably going to seek out more liberal peers rather than hanging out with your conservative parents all the time, right? Thus, maybe reinforcing the development of your values. So this influence of peers being more influential than parents is evident in many ways. If you have a child who hates a given food, like spinach, they will often eat it when they're hanging out with other kids who like that food, right, and are eating it. Kids who hear one accent at home and one in their neighborhood or at school will tend to adopt their peers' accent, right, and their peers' slang, not their parents' accent, suggesting that this might be due to peer influence, right? And teens who smoke often have friends who smoke. So just another kind of example. Of course, as we mentioned, parents might help select peers or lead people to select peers of a certain type. So it's not this simple that you can necessarily say it's one or the other. But it does seem that peers are more influential than parents. Clear? Any questions? Okay. Cool. So let's talk about culture. So culture and human diversity. We know there are many different cultures on this planet, right? There's a very diverse set of people on this planet. So how are these things connected? Culture we can define as the behaviors, ideas, attitudes, values, and traditions that are shared by a group of people and transmitted between generations. Culture allows pretty amazing things to happen. A couple are innovation, preservation, meaning if someone in your culture like invents the wheel, you don't have to reinvent it, right? These innovations, these advances in technology are preserved through culture, preserved through somehow recording the accomplishment, recreating it, teaching it to someone else, etc. Division of labor is also an important thing that culture supports, the idea that we can accomplish more if we all contribute to some shared goal. We know animals display culture, if you remember the potato washing monkeys, and we know that cultures vary in many ways across places and across time. Norms, being the rules for accepted and expected behavior in a given society, differ widely between cultures. You often don't notice it in your own culture, right? I think the analogy in your book is like, it's like when you're in your own culture, It's like riding a bike with the wind, right? You don't notice the influence and the fact that the culture is helping propel you and support you in your endeavors. But when you enter a new culture that you've been in like for the first time, it's like riding against the wind. Suddenly you notice everything that's different, that you've been taking for granted in your own culture, but that's radically different in this new place. Okay, so often you don't notice what all the norms are because they're so internalized and so automatic until you go somewhere new. And this happens across time as well. If you think about the norms for women in the 1950s versus now, things have changed considerably. Okay? So cultures vary in many ways. One big way they vary is in their emphasis on individuality and autonomy versus group harmony. So individualistic cultures, like the U.S., tend to give priority to an individual's goals, right? It's all about the person as an entity, the person being the ultimate thing, the individual. So you define identity as a unique thing and internally derived. It's about your individual attributes. You are a special snowflake, and you are the way you are because that's who you are, right? You were born that way. There's some kernel of you that defines your identity, okay? Collectivist cultures are very different. These cultures tend to give priority to the goals of the group rather than goals of the individual, right? And identity, instead of being this special snowflake, is about being part of this larger fabric of the culture. You're part of the social network. You have roles. You have relationships. There are rules to what you do to people. And you are supposed to maintain these relationships and do your duty, right? It's not about expressing who you are. It's about fulfilling your obligations. Okay? So we'll talk next time about all these crazy differences between individualist and collectivist cultures. I'm going to give you time to pick up your exams and your assignments. They are laid out here, roughly alphabetized. And I hope you have a great weekend.